supporting WHYY Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
This in the Family is made possible in part by the generous support of Devereaux, the nation's largest nonprofit provider of behavioral health care for children, adolescents, and adults with developmental and intellectual disabilities, behavioral disorders, and mental illness. Devereaux operates at 15 centers in 11 states throughout the country.
I'm Dan Gottlieb. Thanks for listening to Voices in the Family. You know, we're talking about transitions today, and we talk about them as though they're unusual or they're unexpected, but that's how life unfolds, huh? We go through them all the time. In intimate relationships, we get married, we get divorced. In families, we have children, and we see them into adulthood and they leave the nest. One of my favorite transitions occurs when a small child takes his or her first steps. And I'm going to talk about that some more later. And we all know that some changes we welcome, others we don't. Whatever the case, transitions have the potential to move us forward to a richer experience in life. They force us to change our narrative about who we are and how we fit in this world. And we're going to hear more about narratives later in the show. It could open us, our lives, to something richer and something more exciting. For me, when I make the transition to retirement, I want to continue to do what I do, but do it with people I can't afford to do it with now. I love listening to people. I love hearing their narrative, and I know it's helpful to them. So I am involved now with the Boys and Girls Club of Camden. I'd love to spend so much more time with those kids. And, you know, I love them and I have something to offer them. I want to spend more time in schools and in prisons, helping people. It's great to look at where we are going as we transition, and we'll do a lot of that on today's show. In this segment, my guest is Jonathan Adler. Jonathan's a clinical psychologist. He teaches at Franklin Olin College of Engineering. He's written about creating our own narrative in the light of our past, present, and future selves in a book called The World Book of Happiness, and he joins us by phone from Massachusetts. Jonathan, welcome to the show.
Oh, thank you for having me.
Later on, we're going to hear from somebody who has studied transitions and written extensively about them. For now, we're going to be talking with Jonathan, and we'd love to hear from you. Our number is 888-477-9499. Again, that's 888-477-9499. So, Jonathan, you know, I alluded to this, that the most difficult part of transition is about our identity, our loss of identity. Who are we now that we've lost our spouse or been forced out of a job? Who are we now that, you know, our children are grown? So what is it about transitions that cause us to lose our identity, and what's that really mean? How do we cope with it?
I think you're exactly right. I think transitions call into question the sense of who we've been and how that person will continue into the future. One of the sort of foundational elements of identity is that it unites us across time and across situations. So So our sense of self is grounded in the idea that the person we were in the past is the same person that we are today and the person that we'll be in the future. And transitions really, really pose a challenge for that.
But, you know, many Buddhists would say that identity is artificial anyway. It's just a construct our egos have us create.
Yeah, absolutely. And from a slightly different perspective, there's a burgeoning field of research in personality psychology that looks at identity as a story. And really as a fiction. I call, in the essay I have in the World Book of Happiness, I call identity the most important fiction, right? It is just a story. We know that from memory research that we aren't always particularly accurate at remembering the specific things that happen to us in an objective way, and yet we are constantly telling stories about the things that happen to us. And yet those stories, although they are reconstructions, have incredible sway over our mental health. And so the stories that we tell are incredibly important to us.
And, you know, I'm thinking of the story in the Bible and, you know, how many people have their identity around that story, that narrative.
Absolutely. So all of our stories are drawn from sort of the menu of available scripts that are out there in our culture to us, and obviously the Bible looms large in many people's. So each of us creates our own story by essentially tailoring master narratives that are out there in the culture and tailoring them for our own lives.
So you've written that happiness can be found by constructing a good story and then living your way into it.
Now, that's right. That's right.
That begs for an explanation, Phil.
Sure. That particular assertion is grounded in a line of research that that I've conducted over the years, and I guess is spoken to most strongly by a study that I have coming out, I think, next month in the Journal of Personality and Social Psychology, where I look at the evolution of people's stories, and I look at it alongside their mental health. So very briefly in this study, I was interested in the way people's identity evolves over the course of psychotherapy, and I got people's stories before they started seeing a therapist, and we followed their stories over the course of their first 12 sessions of treatment, and we also assessed their mental health. And what we found is that their stories changed in certain reliable ways and didn't change in other ways over the course of treatment, but that the story actually started to change before they felt better. So it's not that feeling better sort of enabled them to tell a different story about their lives. It's that they actually started to tell the story differently, and then only after that did they start to feel better. So to me, that's what suggests that people tell a new story and then live their way into it.
Well, you're talking about the evolution of the story, not the construction. Like, I mean, I could tell a story that, you know, I'm Antonio Banderas and I'm this great sex symbol, but that's not all that related to mental health if I lived
that's
my
right.
way into that.
That's right. So our criteria for good stories are different than the kinds of criteria that one would use for like a scientific argument. But that's not to say that there aren't any criteria. And so some kind of believability is an essential criterion. So, you know, certainly people with psychosis tell stories about their lives, but those stories bear very little resemblance to their actual lived experience. And so that questions the validity of their stories and as a result may be less related to their mental health.
I work with many people. We all know many people who define their lives by their childhood trauma, by their disability, and when they do that, they're also predict a future of unhappiness. So,
absolutely.
I wonder, what is it about our wiring, our literal neurology and psychology, that make us try to define our lives in such narrow ways, and then predict our future based on that?
Yeah, that's a fantastic question. Well, so we do know that the human brain is wired to make sense of life in narrative terms. That is sort of a fundamental way that we structure the world and make sense out of the many, you know, stimuli that we get constantly. We weave them into narratives. And I think you're right that people often get fixated on a particular narrative account of their lives. And there are certain potentially, you know, dispositional elements that might lead to that. So, for example, people have certain robust personality traits that are genetically informed and stable across their lives and might lead them to tell certain kinds of stories. That being said, we actually find that the stories people tell are more strongly predictive of their mental health than some of those dispositional personality traits. So even though you might be wired to, you know, be more likely to experience negative emotions, that doesn't mean that if you're able to tell stories that espouse themes that are different than that kind of negative outlook, that actually has power over your mental health. So a pair of themes that we look at are called redemption and contamination. In contamination sequences, stories that start out good have bad endings. And redemption is the opposite. In redemption sequences, stories that start out bad have good endings. And both of these are narrative reconstructions. Neither of them necessarily corresponds to the objective reality. But we find that contamination sequences are just toxic for people's mental health above and beyond the impact of personality traits. And redemption is exactly the opposite. Redemption is very good for you. So I think the story actually does have a lot of power even above and beyond those kind of hardwired genetic components of ourselves.
So let me tell you a bit about my narrative. My narrative
Sure.
is that I've got a learning disability and I don't handle really complex things very well, which is what you psychologist types are prone to do. So here's my read on everything you just said.
Sure.
And that comes right out of 12-step programs. Basically, what you just said was fake it till you make it.
I think that's true.
Yeah, yeah.
I think that there is an element of tell the story and live your way into it.
Yeah, yeah. That's great. That's terrific. Well, it's nice to hear that you know, that bumper sticker has scientific evidence behind it.
Right, that's right.
Terrific. And Thich Nhat Hanh says, you know, he says smiling actually releases endorphins. So if you smile, you will become happier.
Absolutely.
So that's pretty cool. We've got people on the phones who want to join the conversation. Let's start with Ellen. Ellen?
How are you?
I'm good, Ellen. How are you?
Good.
What can we do for you?
Well, I was wondering what everyone's thoughts were about, actually, you mentioned Thich Nhat Hanh just now, his thoughts on the present moment and being in the present. I understand that transitioning often has the most issues when we focus on what we wish the future could be or what we wish the past was not. But if we focus on the present, then transitioning can be a lot easier. So I was wondering what your thoughts were on, you know, how those who have a more Buddhist or present-minded spirituality deal with transitioning versus those of a more Western-minded ideology.
That's a great question. And I think just by virtue of the fact that you asked it, Ellen, you've got a guess about what the answer might be, but let's hear what Jonathan might say about if there's any research on that. I love that question. And thanks for your
sure.
call. Thanks for your call,
yeah.
Ellen. Go on.
So we tend to think about depression as a disorder that looks towards the past, right, feeling bad about things that didn't go the way you wanted them to, and anxiety as a disorder that's about the future, right? It's fear of things that might come. And so certainly there's a huge literature on the benefit of mindfulness and that kind of present moment focus as an ability to cope with difficulty and change. And I think your observation is absolutely right. Whether narrative itself plays it comes into the present, I think narrative is sort of fundamentally about uniting the past, the present, and the future, so that's a little bit different. But I think your inclination that kind of present moment focus is an effective therapeutic way of dealing with difficulty is spot on.
You know, it's funny, coincidence, I am just back from a 5-day silent meditation retreat. And, you know, one of the things that we talked about is kind of the unknown, that it is unknown what's going to happen in the next moment. And we are pretty clueless about it. And the more we can live comfortably with that knowledge, the more in our lives we will be. But that's hard to do. You know, it's like you said, our brains want to understand order and predictability in their lives. The truth is there's very little of that.
That's right. Again, the narratives that we tell are definitely fictions. They are our way of parsing the world into these stories. And you're right. And I think the Buddhist tradition is constantly trying to get us to do the very hard work of stay present in the moment.
Okay. And and by the way, because I've been on that retreat, Jonathan, I want you to know that I'm now enlightened. So don't give me any crap over the course of the show, because
you know,
I'm an enlightened one. Thank you. It lasted for about 4 seconds, and then
those were probably 4 really good seconds.
They were wonderful. Yeah. listen, we've got to take a break, and when we come back, I want to us both to listen to David Levine, our producer Jennifer Lynn interviewed him, and he's doing some really interesting things in his life. He's a medical doctor who took his medical practice to Gambia and Senegal. So we'll listen to that and hear about his transitions. Where we are talking with Jonathan Adler. He's a clinical psychologist. He teaches at the Franklin W. Olin College of Engineering he's written a chapter in the World Book of Happiness. He's talked about creating our own narrative. When we come back, like I said, we're going to hear from the interview with Jennifer Lynn and David Levine. We're also going to hear from Nancy Schlossberg, a professor emeritus at the University of Maryland. And, of course, we'll take your calls. Well, I'm Dan Gottlieb. You're listening to Voices in the Family. It's right here on WHYY-FM.
The Chester County Hospital supports WHYY and is affiliated with the Cleveland Clinic's Heart Surgical Program. Their surgeons are performing breakthrough procedures, including minimally invasive heart valve surgeries. Details at chestercountyhospital.org.
On the next Fresh Air, the story of Rin Tin Tin, a dog found in the wreckage of a kennel during World War I, who would become one of film, radio, and television's biggest stars. We'll talk with author Susan Orlean about her new book, Rin Tin Tin, The Life and the Legend. It's her first original book since her bestseller, The Orchid Thief. Join us.
This afternoon at 3 and again tonight at 7 on WHYY.
Philadelphia Area Friends Schools support WHYY. For more than 300 years, Quaker Schools have offered strong educational programs grounded in ethical values. Details for open houses are online at quakerschools.org.
We are back on Voices in the Family. I'm Dan Gottlieb, your host. We are talking about transitions today. We've been talking with Jonathan Adler, who will continue to stay with us. He's a clinical psychologist. And we're also going to be joined by Nancy Schlossberg, professor emeritus at the University of Maryland. She's written extensively about transitions and retirement. But first, I want to introduce you to someone else. It takes a special kind of person to transition from all that, quote, safe, traditional, and successful into something that is, well, not. It's, for lack of a better phrase, it's iffy, it's risky, it's, well, different. David Levine is just that person. He's a Philadelphia-born physician, medical doctor, who's done things differently most of his life. At one point, he spent 14 months living on a sailboat with his family. Then about 6 years ago, he took his medical practice to the West African nations of Gambia and Senegal. On a recent visit to the Philadelphia area, he spoke with our producer, Jennifer Lynn, about his transition and what he's learned from it.
2005, I was inspired by a book that I read by Tracy Kidder. It's called Mountains Beyond Mountains, and it's about Dr. Paul Farmer, who, as a medical student from Boston, went down to Haiti and worked in the highlands of Haiti. He was inspired by the abject need of the people there and established a clinic, which has become a major center. And he's done amazing things. Anyway, I got really turned on to that idea of doing some medicine in the third world. And so I had a few contacts and ended up in the Gambia, which is the smallest country in mainland Africa. There was so little to work with. There was a lack of equipment. There was a lack of medication. And there was a lack of organization. The pace of intervention was almost always very slow. And consequently, I had people die in front of me that didn't need to die. The courage and the long suffering of the people there was extraordinary. I remember a fellow who had been brought in who had gotten a very bad electrical shock. Not long after, another man came in who'd been snake bitten, and they were lying near each other on gurneys. This man with the electric shock was probably not going to live, but he was reaching over and comforting the other man. And it just extraordinary examples of courage and patience and tolerance that existed. The experience has changed me. I'm a lot more tolerant of annoyances. I have also come to accept death as an inevitability much more than I ever did before, that there are some things that you simply can't prevent and that you have to accept. It's a fatalistic kind of attitude, and people in West Africa have to have that or they'd go crazy.
Did you ever hesitate to go, or was it a big decision, or was it a natural decision?
It was not a big decision for me. I wanted to do it. So, and you know how they say, fools jump in with where angels fear to tread. And so that I've always jumped in. So that puts me in a particular category automatically.
That was David Levine talking with our producer, Jennifer Lynn. By the way, he's back in the States now, and he's here to raise money for West African Medicine and Education. It's a charity he founded that helps individuals obtain medical care. You can link to his group if you want to know more about it. You can link to his group on our website. Well, like I said earlier, we're joined by Jonathan Adler, who you met in the first segment of our show. We're now joined by Nancy Schlossberg, a professor emeritus at the University of Maryland. Nancy, welcome to the show.
Well, I've enjoyed listening. Well, it's been very interesting.
Well, thank you. Emeritus usually means that you are retired.
Well, what my daughter says about me is that the only thing retired about me is my paycheck. And that's true, and I do miss it. I am retired voluntarily from the university, but I still do a lot of things. I'm a continuer. I still continue writing, giving workshops, giving speeches. I don't teach anymore. I don't want to anymore. Only because I don't want to grade papers anymore. But at any rate, I had a wonderful career, and it was wonderful being at Maryland, and I'm having a very fruitful retirement.
You've looked at transitions over the course of your career through a different lens. You've looked not only at retirement, but adults going back to school and even people losing jobs and careers. So I'd like to take a look at people who have lost jobs. Boy, if our identity is tied up into anything, it's about job and career. So tell us what happens to them internally.
Well, it's such an assault on your ego. And even if I did some work at NASA Space Flight Center, the Goddard plant, years ago when they had what they called a RIF, reduction in force. And my colleague and I interviewed everybody the week they were RIFed and 6 months later. And, of course, the week they, it was right before Christmas that they learned about the beginning of December, when they learned they were, their jobs were eliminated. And I can tell you the stories were awful. What they said, they like, it's worse than a diagnosis of cancer. I've been kicked in the back. I've been, you know, everybody was miserable except two people at the beginning. One was a top executive who said he was very bored with his life. He was bored with his wife, and this was the push he needed to move on. And the other was a grass cutter who said he didn't care where he cut grass. He thought he could get a job at the airport. Now, that's the beginning of the story. Most people were devastated. Two were, one wasn't concerned, and the other was happy. So when we followed them up 6 months later, we expected misery, misery, misery. And what was unbelievable is the change. I'd say most of the people said, I've learned that if I can handle this, I can handle anything. So we tried to examine what intervened, what made it possible for them to feel good at the end of 6 months, because I had anticipated they would be, you know, near suicide, but they weren't. The reason was, it was very different than the movie Up in the Air with George Clooney. What it was that NASA, of course, got the a week of counseling for them, but NASA did something more. Everyone whose job was let go was attached to what they called a buddy, to somebody in the organization who would see them every week and work with them until they replaced their job. So the support system that NASA put in place really made a tremendous difference. And that led me to realize you cannot generalize and say everybody's going to be miserable or some people, because everybody is so different. And this was a fascinating study for me, and I learned a lot.
Well, I can go on,
but why don't you?
Yeah, Jonathan, you might argue that this is about people who change their narrative. Certainly the man who was cutting the grass almost didn't need to change his narrative.
Exactly.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So there are two components of really good narratives in response to this kind of, you know, major adversity or challenge. One is you have to first really explore and get in there with the difficult part. So for people who just gloss over any difficulty, they don't seem to get the same bang out of their stories as the people who first really get in there and explore it. But the second part is the key, which is finding some coherent positive resolution. And that's how we get this kind of positive self-transformation in the wake of challenges. So the story that, this really astounding story of, you know, if I can handle this, I can handle anything, that sounds like the prototypical redemption sequence to me. Without this challenge that was really hard, I really suffered, you know, you really get in there and explore the negative, I would never have learned about this strength that I have. And that kind of positive transformation in the story is really powerful for people's mental health.
Hmm. Let's go to the phones. We've got Doug on the line. Hey, Doug.
Hi, Dan. This is Doug Barton. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I'm listening to what Dr. Adler has to say with a great deal of fascination. I'll tell you why I'm calling. Obviously, there is a great deal of transition that's imposed on us against our will, and a lot of that is quite negative in nature. And I'm thinking in particular about the rate of unemployment that we're facing in the country right now, with about 15 million people out of work, and probably another 20 million family members. I have a blog that's called Psych Up for Job Search that I co-author with psychologist Dr. Manny in Springhouse. And we recently posted a blog that says, your story is more valuable than you think. And it's based on some work that was done at Southern Methodist University about 15 years ago. And the folks there discovered that people who write their deepest thoughts and emotions about job loss find that it's very helpful. Some of the benefits include lowering the stress, as indicated by a reduction in blood pressure, loss of weight, and increased heart rate. So I'm just wondering if Dr. Adler has any suggestions for folks who are out of work who are kind of devastated or feeling negative about their life situation.
Well,
they're feeling frustrated about not being able to find work in a timely fashion.
I'm going to take your question, Doug. Thank you for calling and pass it over to both Jonathan and Nancy. But I do want to say this. I want to challenge you, Jonathan, and Doug. You know, it's great to change your narrative, and it's great to tell your story when you've lost your job. But you know, you still have to eat too. That's an issue about how happy you're going to be. You know,
absolutely,
you can feed your family.
Absolutely, and there's no denying that objective reality has a major influence on our mental health as well. I would never suggest that your narrative is the only way to influence your mental health, or that it can trump things like your basic needs not being met. That being said, what the caller said is exactly right, that many of the things that happen to us are objectively beyond our control. However, the stories that we tell about them really are in our control. And one of the things that I find most interesting about stories is that we are both the main character in our stories and the narrator, right? So we live most of our lives as the main character, going about and doing our lives. And every once in a while, something happens to us that really throws us out of that role and forces us to be the narrator, to really pay attention to what's been going on. And so
give us an example.
Well, I think the one we've been talking about is a perfect one. This kind of, you know, job loss, right? When you get fired, it's not in your control. And so sort of how you respond to it is in your control. And of course, there are active things you can do, like looking for another job and all those kinds of strategies. But on the psychological side, one of the most robust themes that we find over and over again that's related to mental health is a theme of agency. So this is the portraying the main character in your story as though he or she is in the driver's seat of your lives, has some control over your life. And again, we're talking in story terms here, not objectively. But if you can find some way of telling that story.
Weigh in here.
With a sense, yeah, go ahead.
I'm fascinated with what you're saying because I'm interested in narrative work, but my model of transitions, which I developed, which started with the first study on geographical moving, because that was an ordinary transition and everybody moves, and that was my first study. But over the years, I must have done about 20 transition studies, and with some measurement people, developed a model for trying to understand any transition. And I think you implied it's never one thing. I call it, in my more recent work, which is more popular, or at least I hope it's popular, I call it the 4S system, because an ordinary person reading Overwhelmed, Coping with Life's Ups and Downs, which is a book I wrote for people, not an academic book. In the academic books, I call it variables, but I call it the 4S system. And it's really based on a lot of the work of Lowenthal and Shiraboga many years ago, Four Stages of Life. But this, you cannot understand the way you're going to navigate a transition unless you look at four factors that are very complex. You have to look at your situation at the time of the job loss. If you are single, if you have a bank account, That's different than the person who's married with four children and has no resources.
So the first thing, Nancy, I know we're right up on a break here.
And, okay, that's fine.
And I know your S's involve, you know, you're talking about the situation, and, you know, you also talk about how important it is for support in your life and your internal coping strategies, and all of that makes all the sense in the world. So we're going to come back. We're going to take a short break, and we're going to come back. We're going to talk more about what we need to do to make our transitions easier, and we're also going to be talking with Vicki Solot. She's now the former president and artistic director of First Person Arts here in Philadelphia. And she's here in the studio. She'll share her thoughts about her transition into retirement and see if she can give me some ideas for me when the time comes. Well, I'm Dan Gottlieb. You're listening to Voices in the Family. It's right here on WHYY FM.
Iowans take pride in their caucuses, but voters in New Hampshire will remind you that their primary is the first in the nation. Now the battle for the Republican nomination comes to the Granite State, and NPR News is there. I'm Mara Liasson. Join us for results, reaction, and analysis when the votes are tallied tomorrow. Live coverage of the New Hampshire primary from NPR News.
Coverage begins tomorrow night at 8 on WHYY.
What do you think might help change the mindset of a convicted criminal? Tougher punishments, longer sentences? How about knitting? There's a waiting list for lessons at a prison in Maryland, and their teacher, Lynn Zwirling, says that's as simple as knit one, purl two.
Someone who knits is not going to be violent.
Knitting and other stories from behind bars. That's next time on Tell Me More.
This afternoon at 1 on WHYY.
We are back on Voices in the Family. I'm Dan Gottlieb, your host. We're talking about transitions of all stripes, voluntary and involuntary. We're talking with Jonathan Adler, joins us by phone from Massachusetts. He's a psychologist and educator at the Franklin W. Olin College of Engineering. He's written about writing one's own narrative in the World Book of Happiness. Nancy Schlossberg's on the phone with us. She's a professor emeritus at the University of Maryland, who's written many books about transitions and retirement. And as promised, I'm here with Vicki Solot, former president and artistic director of First Person Arts in Philadelphia. So what's that like for you, Vicki, when I say the word former president?
Good. It's good to be out of the driver's seat. It's good to be free of the stress and responsibility of running an organization. And it's exciting to look toward the future. I didn't feel like this over the last few months of my tenure, maybe 6 months, when I knew I was going to be leaving.
How long have you been out?
Oh, just Christmas Eve was my last day. But from about July on, I started, you know, transitioning out of that position and thinking about the future. And initially, I was terrified. I felt like I was dropping off into an abyss. And I was fortunate to take a trip during the summer with some friends. It was a walking trip in the Cotswolds, where we walked 50 miles over a course of 4 days. And the beauty of the landscape and the camaraderie of being with friends and being on a trip without having a proposal that I had to complete hanging over my head was so liberating. And it was kind of this epiphany where I realized there's life after work for me. So that really was a turning point for me in thinking about this transition. And from then on, I started thinking about the things that I was going to be shedding. I mean, there have been moments when I thought, what am I going to do next? Or how's it going to be not to have this, you know, sort of critical role?
How is it?
But so far it feels great.
Hmm. Your identity, has it shifted?
Well, it's so new that it's hard to know that, and I was very fortunate to be able to take another trip to Oaxaca, Mexico, the day after my last day at work. And so, I mean, travel is always great, but it was also a good transition in the sense that I was exploring new things. I took some Spanish lessons. My husband and I took Spanish lessons while we were there. And I started thinking about, you know, the beauty of another culture and interests in things that I've sort of always toyed with. I have this loom that somebody bought for me when I was in my 30s, and I've not touched since then, and went to see weavers while we were there, and I thought, oh, weaving, I could do some weaving while I'm here. During this period of time, and I could really take up Spanish in a serious way. So all these things that I had to leave behind that are interests of mine, I think, can become part of my new identity.
Did you always smile as much as you are right now?
Probably not. No, I don't know. I think I feel really relaxed.
Well, that's way cool. Nancy, I'm listening to Vicki, and all of this sounds wonderful, but I'm also thinking, well, she also has the resources to take these wonderful trips
and
to learn Spanish. And so what do we do if we don't have those things?
Well, as we've been talking about the challenges, I'm a very concrete person. I'm not a mystical person. I'm very concrete. And in my books on retirement, especially the last book, Revitalizing Retirement, I talk about the necessity to look at your psychological portfolio. We all, if we're lucky enough to have a financial portfolio, we look at our finances, but we really haven't looked ahead at our psychological portfolio. And that is your identity, how you tag yourself, and how that evolves over time. It's interesting to see cards people make up when they retire and 6 months and 6 years later. But you also have to look at purpose, because if you don't have a sense of purpose, if you don't have something that makes you want to get up in the morning, you'll get depressed. And then you have to look at your changing relationships, and that's a big one. You are losing work relationships. You might keep them for a little while, but you are giving up and leaving behind a lot of things that gave you a sense of self, and you need to create new relationships. I could go on about that, but let me stop. I would like to do with people before they retire and then after is help them look at their psychological portfolio and help them see ways they can strengthen their portfolio.
I think that's a great idea and great advice. It seems like Jill, Vicki, for example, had a pretty healthy psychological portfolio.
Right.
And getting back to the issue of narrative, Jonathan, we all want our lives to have meaning. So I imagine that's got to be part of the narrative, especially as we age, yes?
Yes, that's one of what we talk about as one of the two fundamental roles of narrative. One is to provide our lives with a sense of meaning and purpose, and the other, as I mentioned earlier, is to unite us across time and situation and give us a mm-hmm. sense of unity. So unity and purpose being the two main goals of narrative.
Hmm.
One of the things I do want to throw in here for the person who needs a job, who has no resources, I talk about for now jobs. Get anything. Just take a for now job and use the time to think creatively about what you would really love to do if you had all the resources in the world. In the meantime, you've got the for now job. And that could be a great job working at Starbucks. I don't care how low level it is. You've got to have a job so you can take home a little money. But then you have to hopefully... There is that inner push that Jean Cohn, the late psychiatrist, talked about, that in aging we have this inner push, and hopefully that inner push will help you survive through the very difficult times and use this time as a way to study, to talk to gurus, to go on kind retreats if you can afford.
Yeah, kind of what Vicky's doing. Vicky, you had a comment.
Well, I was just thinking about this issue of narrative, and you know, First Person Arts was actually an organization about narrative. My background is in theater, and so I think in terms of productions. You know that each phase of life is a new production, and so maybe our lives as a narrative are not novels as much as they are a series of short stories. And in theater, you know, you work really hard, you get a production up, and then it ends, and you move on to the next thing. And so I think that way of looking at the world and that impulse is helpful in retirement. It's also helpful in any kind of job transition or other transition, that this is a thing that you're going to go through for a period of time and then move on to the next thing.
Yeah, I mean, it's really interesting because, you know, like I said in the introduction, we're all surprised by transitions, and you know, that's how we live our lives, you know, and mm-hmm. and it's like we don't expect them, which is kind of silly. It's you know, a silly thing we do to ourselves. Let's go back to the phones. We've got Jill on the line. Jill, hi, you're on the air. Do we have you, Jill? I guess we don't. We don't have Jill. Jonathan, you know, we're thinking about our narratives. As I age, and I'm 65 now, my story becomes more about my experience of who I am rather than any labels like psychologist or a disabled person or father or grandfather. It becomes more about my experience of my life.
Yeah, well, we're all constantly revising our life stories from the time we start to tell them in adolescence all the way through adulthood and into the later stages of life. We're constantly revising our story. And I love the way Vicky talked about the enthusiasm she has in writing this next chapter or writing this next short story. I think that's a wonderful way to head into that phase of life.
Vicky, you know, we're talking about meaning in life and giving back at this stage. Your career has been about giving back and making the world a better place. You've lived your passion by and large. So do you ever feel that you've done all your good deeds, you've paid your dues, and now it's time to be thinking about you?
Well, I think I would like to do some thinking about me and to have a little bit more luxury to do that. But actually, I feel like the last 10 years when I was running First Person Arts was more about really pursuing the things that interested me and in the course of it, influencing other people and giving other people opportunities. But probably not so much giving back to the least privileged among us, and I think that that's another thing that I would like to do during this next phase, or at least to combine it. I was thinking, oh, I can learn Spanish, but I can do it.
That's great. Listen, I've got some observations I want to make about transitions. I'm going to say goodbye to all our guests first with my great thanks for their time and their wisdom. I've been talking with Jonathan Adler, Nancy Schlossberg, and Vicky Solat. Thanks so much to all three of you for joining us today. It's been a fun show.
Thanks for having me.
Sure.
Thank you.
And I would like to share with you some of my observations on what transitions mean to me. Nearly 3 years ago, I had the privilege of watching my little friend Jacob take his first step. He'd been able to climb up on a piece of furniture pretty easily, and he let go for a few seconds at a time, but now he seemed ready. His mother was a couple of feet away, and she held out her hand. He let go of the chair and just stood there for a minute, almost as though he was contemplating his next move. He held onto the chair again briefly, and then he let go, of what was secure as he took his first step, not knowing what would happen next. And don't all the stories begin the same way? In Genesis, when Abraham was told to leave what's familiar, and the journey begins. Whether it's a career change or a divorce, or in my case, how my journey really began when I became a quadriplegic 30 years ago, and I had no idea who I was anymore, let alone how I fit into the world. And after years of shock and self-pity, something inside opened up into a new life. And it's really the same story with every transition, whether it's voluntary or not. Either we let go of something secure, or we have it taken from us, but the next step is always into the unknown. We have no choice about how the journey works, it just works that way. But perhaps we can make that transition without as much fear and trepidation. Like Jacob and Abraham, like the rest of us, letting go of what's familiar is always an act of faith. The poet Apollinaire captured it beautifully in his poem Daydreams. "Come to the edge," he said. "We can't. We're afraid." "Come to the edge," he said. "We can't. We'll fall." "Come to the edge," he said. And they came, and he pushed, and we flew. And boy, do I wish flight for all of us who find ourselves near the edge. We've been talking about transitions today on the show with Jonathan Adler, Nancy Schlossberg, and Vicki Solot. And thank you, my listeners, my friends, for joining us. Next week on Voices in the Family, we'll be preempted by special programming in honor of Martin Luther King Jr. Day. But join us on the 23rd for a show about social capital. It promises to be really interesting. Well, you can email us at voices@whyy.org, and you can reach me at drdangottlieb.com. Well, the engineer for today's show's been Al Banks. Thank you, Al. Elizabeth Perez Luna is our executive producer for audio content. Emily Haas is our volunteer, and we hope you feel better, Emily. Mike and Scott's our executive producer. Jennifer Lynn is our producer. Me, I'm Dan Gottlieb. Hey, enjoy your week, my friends.